That's the Kenny Drew Quintet with Groovin' the Blues, starting off with Hank Mobley on tenor sax, Kenny Drew is on piano, Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, Sam Jones on bass, and Louis Hayes on drums. That's from the Undercurrent album released in 1960. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Monday, March the 10th, and a great, great program. I hope you would agree we have in store. It concerns a concept promoted by a rather provocative law professor, Louis Michael Seidman, and it is the concept of constitutional disobedience. The framers of the U.S. Constitution never meant for it to be this unassailable, fixed, final word on the law of the land, but really the basis for vigorous debate and even open challenges in pursuit of a more just and democratic society. Too much deference is given to the Constitution, says our guest, and not enough difference taken with it, he says, in his recently published book, On Constitutional Disobedience. Professor Seidman, nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, let me tell folks about who you are. You are the Carmack Waterhouse Professor of Constitutional Law at Georgetown University, where Professor Seidman teaches constitutional and criminal law. He is co-author of a constitutional law casebook and the author of many articles concerning criminal justice and constitutional law. His most recent books, besides the one we're talking about today, I'll be referencing throughout our conversation, Constitutional Disobedience, he counts Silence and Freedom, Equal Protection of the Laws, Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense for Constitutionalism and Judicial Review, and Remnants of Belief, Contemporary Constitutional Issues, among his most recent books. So once again, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
So I was intrigued about this idea of constitutional disobedience and why you say that the Constitution gets too much reverence as it is, and it ought to have a bit more rebellion.
Well, the American Constitution is the oldest in the world. It was written several centuries ago, or most of it was. It's almost impossible to amend, and it would be very, very strange if all of the solutions to 21st century problems were found in an 18th century document. So it just seems, on the face of it, really peculiar to think that this document, this flawed document with many idiosyncratic provisions in it, should govern our national life.
But it does, and great care has been taken to make sure that it does.
Well, you know, whether it does or not is actually more complicated than you might think. In the first place, many provisions in the Constitution are quite vague and open-ended, and so you have this really bizarre situations where the justices on the right read the Republican Party platform into this language, and the justices on the left read the Democratic Party platform into the same language. And what seems to be happening most of the time is, instead of the Constitution determining what happens, you have people pretending to rely on the Constitution when, in fact, what they're doing is just inflicting their own political judgments on the rest of us.
So why a Constitution in the first place?
Well, I guess I just ought to make clear, first of all, that I'm not talking about constitutions in general. I'm talking about the American Constitution and the role that the American Constitution plays in 21st century America. So I can imagine situations where writing a constitution would settle destabilizing civil war, or whether or cases where the act of writing the Constitution would establish a sense of national identity. There are good things that constitutions can do. But the United States Constitution is very, very old. The compromises that it made are about issues that are no longer salient. It's got provisions in it that are just obviously out of date or downright evil. And it serves a particular function in our politics today, which is cutting off debate or misdirecting debate about issues of public policy that we ought to be actively engaged in.
Well, let's take a look at the historical context of the U.S. Constitution. It was a time when basically something had to bring the nations together, and it was, I guess, a nice kind of a contract agreement among the several states as to how they were going to work out a relationship with each other and forge a, quote, nation, unquote. But built into this were so many inconsistencies. The main one that I could think of course, is the ironic issue that many of the framers were themselves slaveholders, and slavery was a huge part of the conversation that some people did not want to have, and others wanted to have it, but were willing to compromise on it. So from the very beginning, one could argue that the Constitution was born in a crucible of unconstitutional precepts, if you will.
Well, that's exactly right. I don't mean to bash the framers. For the time they lived in, they had a lot of really quite brilliant ideas. Unfortunately, they also had some really terrible ideas, and you've mentioned one of them. So the delegates to the Constitutional Convention from the slaveholding states made very clear that they would not agree to a document that did not provide protection for them, and the document was laced with protections for slavery. But that's not the only strange idea they had. They also, most of them, thought that women had no role to play in public life. They thought that only people with property should be allowed to vote. Most of them were fundamentally against democracy. A big part of the impetus to get rid of the Articles of Confederation was that they believed the states were way too democratic and had to be reined in. And then they just had ideas that, you know, might have made sense in a small rural republic huddled along the eastern seaboard in the 18th century, but just make no sense in the United States in the 22nd or the 21st century.
Well, the process of keeping current with the times, you already clearly said that it's been ridiculously painstaking and actually designed to resist any kind of an update, considering that there have been more than 11,370 attempts to make some amends. So I imagine that it is kind of it has some bulletproof built in into the Constitution. But
well, it really does. In some ways, the most pernicious provisions in the Constitution are in Article 5, which deal with amendment. It's the most difficult Constitution in the world to amend. There hasn't been an amendment since 1971. And there are many provisions that are functionally impossible to amend. So the clearest example, I think, is the composition of the United States Senate. So you have all three people who live in Wyoming, they get their own two senators, and the millions and millions of people who live in California also get two senators. So I guess the lesson here is if you want to be a senator, you ought to move to Wyoming. Unless you're Liz Cheney, I suppose. So that's just, I don't know anybody who defends that today, but actually the Constitution itself says that that provision cannot be amended. And even if someone tried to amend it, the states that are overrepresented would block it in the Senate. So we're just stuck with that, with something that has a profound effect on our politics and that is just completely indefensible.
But how do you therefore advocate disobedience to a document that is so deeply embedded in the psyche of a nation? And even with all of its contradictions and even with all of the built-in resistance to amendment, how do you make that case that we
right.
should embark upon constitutional disobedience? And what is that anyway?
Well, those are two very big questions. Let me start with the first one. So one thing that might help, I think, is if people better understood that this is not an idea that I came up with alone. It's been an idea advocated by many, many of the heroes of American history. So I could give you lots and lots of examples, but let me just give you a few. We can start with Thomas Jefferson, who strongly believed and said many times during his life that it was fundamentally wrong for one generation of Americans to bind another generation. And the most consequential act of his administration, the Louisiana Purchase, is something he did despite his own conviction that it was unconstitutional. And he did it because he thought it was best for the country. Or we could talk about the abolitionists, real heroes in the history of our country, people like William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips. Garrison publicly burned a copy of the Constitution on the 4th of July and declared that it was a pact with the devil. And a fact that people, I think, mostly have chosen to forget, the Emancipation Proclamation, maybe the greatest act in American history, just months before that, Lincoln himself had said that it would be unconstitutional for the president to free the slaves. He did it anyway, and as I say, it was a courageous and great act. Theodore Roosevelt in 1912 ran on the proposition that the people should govern the United States and not courts interpreting the Constitution. I could go on and on. So there's a long history of people, our greatest leaders, saying what I'm saying. Now, it's not as if the Supreme Court tomorrow is going to just announce that it's not obeying the Constitution or that Congress is going to pass a resolution saying that, but what's required is a cultural change, and the way cultural change comes about is one conversation at a time. So I have a suggestion for your listeners. The next time you hear somebody make a constitutional argument, say that somebody says that's unconstitutional, you should say, so what? And start a conversation about it. Right? And I'm not saying this is going to happen tomorrow. It may never happen. But sometimes cultural change comes more quickly than anybody expected.
Well, you do seem to be kind of, how should I say, a bit flippant. About this sacred document, and I'm sure this has incurred the wrath of many in your field.
Well, so first of all, I do think one problem is people treating it as a sacred document. The Constitution is not the Word of God; it's not the Bible. It's a document written by human beings, some of whom were very smart, but who had also had some odd ideas about things and ideas that are out of date. So the first thing we need to do, and I don't mean to be flippant about this, I'm actually very serious about it, but we need to demystify the document, admire the great things in it, but stop paying attention to the things that are not so great. Now, has this upset some people? Yeah, sure it has. It's an unfamiliar idea to many people, but as I say, it has a long lineage in American history. And I do think if you just stop to think about it for a moment, what's really bizarre is not constitutional disobedience, but constitutional obedience. Mm. So just imagine for a moment that you were trying to decide on some important issue of public policy. Maybe you're the president or on the Supreme Court or just an ordinary citizen, and you spend a long time thinking about it, and you talk to a lot of people, and you read a lot, and in the end, you decide the right thing to do, all things considered, is X. And then just as you're about to do X, somebody rushes into the room and says, wait a second, don't do it yet. You need to know that people who've been dead for 225 years, many of whom thought it was okay to own other human beings and that women had no role to play in public governance, they wrote down in this document to do not X. And then you shake your head and you say, oh, well, in that case, I think I'll do not X. I mean, you'd have to have your head examined, right? That's the position that's really bizarre.
So what replaces a constitution, in your view? What is a good alternative?
Well, I think that it's not as if we're starting from scratch. We have very well established ways of doing things and ways of thinking about things that are formed by a couple of hundred years of history. And the burden of proof is going to be on people who want to change the way we're doing things. So many things will just stay the same way they are because we've been doing them that way for a very long time. But the difference will be that if somebody says, well, we should do something different, it will not be a full and complete answer to that to say, no, we can't because the Constitution prevents us. The people who want to keep doing things the same way are going to have to offer reasons for doing them the same way, and then we will decide about that the way we decide about everything else. There'll be political mechanisms that will resolve questions one way or the other.
I'm stunned by that.
Well, don't be stunned.
I'm stunned by that answer because you know what we go through to get even one logical thing done in Congress, this would be done.
And as I say, I think most things, for just that reason, most things aren't going to change. I mean, we have a lot of gridlock. I understand that. I do think, though, that the impulse toward constitutional obedience, I'm not saying it's the main cause of our political malfunction, but I think it's one of the causes, because one really unfortunate thing that invoking the Constitution does is it raises the temperature of political argument. So just to take an almost random example, you and I might have a different opinion about gun control. And maybe some people think it's a good idea and some people think it's a bad idea. And God knows we can talk about social science studies and all sorts of stuff about that. But if it's just about a public policy like gun control, you and I can more or less agree to disagree in a friendly way. But as soon as somebody invokes the Second Amendment, then all of a sudden, we're not just talking about a public policy disagreement. What we're talking about is loyalty to our foundational document. And so you're not just saying, you know, you're wrong about this study or that study. You're saying you're not a real American because you're willing to violate, as you said, our sacred charter. And at that point, I'm not going to take that sitting down, right? I'm going to be pretty angry about that. And I think that gets in the way of the kind of deliberation that is the hallmark of a mature democracy, where we can understand that people in good faith can disagree and try to, in one way or another, hash out our disagreement.
How much wrong or injustice do you think has been done because of constitutional interpretation over time, where it is understood that once a thing is found to be constitutional, it is therefore not just legal, but correct?
Well, I do think that's a big problem. So people assume that because something's permitted by the Constitution, therefore it ought to be immune from change. But in some ways, the bigger problem is the opposite, where a court has said, or the document itself says, that we're not allowed to do something, and that prevents us from doing it. So I've already mentioned the United States Senate. I guess because I live in the District of Columbia, I'm especially upset about another provision in the Constitution, which means that I'm not allowed to vote for the people who control my life, that is to say, representatives in the House and the Senate. Again, that's something I think very few people would defend on the merits, and it is evil. It's just wrong. And it might have made sense in 1787, but it doesn't make sense today.
Could you discuss and we can't avoid the discussion about the racial aspect of life in the United States, and much of policymaking, much of any kind of decision in the law and so forth. There is, we have started in an apartheid state. How does the Constitution, as you see it now, as it exists now, how does it injure or further injure the rights of people who, from the very beginning at the forging of this document, were seen as really not worthy of being even counted in the conversation?
Well, you know, I think people have a kind of distorted view about that because of a very brief sliver in our history, which is usually referred to as the Warren Court era, where the Supreme Court, not entirely, but certainly more than other times in our history, stood for racial justice. The fact of the matter is, if you discount that relatively small period of time, for most of the history before the Warren Court, the Supreme Court was the most regressive force in our country, invalidating federal statutes that were meant to control racism, upholding separate but equal, upholding literacy tests for voting, and so on. And if you look at more recent history, I think we see much the same pattern. So with no clear anchoring in the text of the Constitution, the Supreme Court has been an important obstacle to affirmative action. Just recently, the court invalidated Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. The court has upset many efforts to create voting districts that accurately reflect the voting strength of African Americans. So the notion that the Supreme Court has mostly been an instrument for racial progress is a myth. And of course, as we've already talked about, the original Constitution itself, never mind the court, contained many provisions that were designed to protect and institutionalize slavery and racial domination.
Considering that many state constitutions are a bit more recent than the U.S. Constitution, do you think that the chances of amending state constitutions might be easier than taking on the big kahuna?
Well, Most state, in fact, all state constitutions are much easier to amend than the United States Constitution, and they are amended frequently. And in fact, a number of states have provisions that that state that their constitutions just expire periodically and have to be readopted. So I would like to see us move in that direction with regard to the federal constitution. Unfortunately, though, amending state constitutions doesn't solve the problem with the federal constitution, because under the supremacy clause of the federal constitution takes precedence over state constitutions. So if there's something bad in the federal constitution, you can't get rid of it just by amending a state constitution.
What is the nature of the discussion in your neck of the woods, in constitutional law? How far has this discussion gotten?
So I think it's fair to say that there's almost nobody who takes my view. I'm sorry to admit that even my wife and my kids think I'm a little nuts. But you know, there on the left and the right in the academy, there is more skepticism about constitutional law and the Supreme Court than you might at first expect. I think many, many people, both on the left and the right, do recognize that when the Supreme Court pretends to be enforcing the Constitution, in many, many cases, what it's doing instead is just replicating political division in the country. So, you know, what a surprise. Five justices on the Supreme Court who happen to be conservatives look at the text and history of the Second Amendment and conclude that gun controls or some forms of gun control is unconstitutional, and four justices who happen to be liberal look at the same text and history and reach the opposite conclusion. You'd really have to be quite naive to miss that fact when it occurs over and over again, and many people who teach in law schools have not missed it. I think more to the point, I don't think the American people have missed it. So, you know, we're in this very odd and I think unstable situation where on the one hand, people express reverence for the Constitution, but on the other, they are quite cynical about it. So polling data shows that a majority of Americans understand that the Supreme Court is often acting politically, and many more Americans than you might expect understand that the Constitution itself is out of date and needs to be brought up to date.
Is there a country, to your knowledge, that has a sensible national document, a national constitution that basically reflects level-headed thinking by its citizens?
So I just really have to say I'm not an expert on comparative constitutional law. So I know a little bit about some other constitutions, but not enough to really talk knowledgeably about them. And I do really think it's important to understand that our judgments about these things are and ought to be deeply contextual. So what you would have to do if you're, say, thinking about the South African constitution or the German constitution or something, it's not just that you need to know a lot about that document. You need to know a lot about that country and about the way the document functions in the politics of a country at a particular time and place. All that said, I do think that almost all of the other constitutions in the world are more up to date because they were written more recently and because they're easier to amend, and they're therefore in that sense less harmful. They're less likely to obstruct progress by keeping us tied to judgments that might have made sense a long time ago but no longer make sense.
So when you were teaching constitutional law, and especially with your particular mindset about it, are you giving, you know, cliff notes to your students and telling them, this is a pothole over here, and there's a pothole over there? Are you identifying the weak spots of the Constitution?
So this is really an important point, actually. When I teach, what I view myself doing primarily is teaching students how to think hard and think critically. I don't view my job as indoctrinating them with my point of view. I would not be successful in doing that, even if I tried, and I don't try. So, first of all, if you're graduating from the Georgetown University Law Center, you do need to know constitutional doctrine. For better or worse, lawyers need to know what the Supreme Court has said about things so that they can understand that and make arguments. And people who take constitutional law from me learn all that. But then you also need to think critically about standard ideas and about my ideas. So I'm not shy about telling students what I think, but the way to get a good grade from my course is not by just repeating what I think, it's by thinking hard yourself.
By doing what it is you say that the institution should be doing, which is questioning the
document. And what American citizens should be doing. And, mm-hmm. you know, we do have a history in this country, one that I'm proud of Americans not accepting, not deciding what they think based on what their betters tell them. And their, quote, betters are not just people now with more money or more power or, you know, law professors or something like that. It's also the people who wrote the Constitution. They have no right to tell us what we think. We need to decide that for ourselves.
Well, we'll take a short break and we'll come back to your questions for Professor Lewis, Michael Seidman, the author of this book that is the basis of our discussion today on constitutional disobedience. We'll be back right after this very tiny break. 888-874-4888 is the number to call for a conversation with Louis Michael Seidman with his concept. It's not his. He made that clear. It's not his alone. He's part of the movement for constitutional disobedience. What have you learned so far? What tickles your fancy about the information shared so far? Let's know. 888-874-4888. I have to tell you that the book is, it's a small book, just five chapters, but it is very compelling reading.
And oh, well, thank you.
Yes, it is, because, you know, it comes at you from an entirely different perspective, and you go, well, wait a minute, this makes sense. I never thought about this, and yet you know that some of the themes that you have covered are so familiar in our regular discussions every day. We touch on these things, but it's quite a remarkable thing to discover that you have them listed in here, and you go, yeah, well, I was thinking that. So it's quite a readable book, and
very
insightful. Very much so.
So one thing that sometimes people are confused about that maybe it would be worthwhile straightening out, the fact that I'm against constitutional obedience doesn't mean that I'm for disobeying everything in the Constitution. So the Constitution has lots of good things in it, protections for speech and liberty and equality. The point that I want to make is when there are good things in the Constitution, we ought to do them not because they're in the Constitution, but because they are good things. And if the Constitution has things that are bad, then we ought not to do them just because they're in the Constitution.
All right. This is not just gratuitous stuff. You're talking very serious things here. But what the way you put it in the book, the way you course people along your line of reasoning, it sounds very conversational. It is not beyond the understanding of anyone. And it makes sense. It really does make sense, because we have had these conversations. I could tell you that on this program. We've had these conversations about the Constitution very often, and it was very refreshing to see that you had addressed these issues in the course of the discussion. So I really want to recommend the book. It's a very,
so I
very
think
good
I
book.
Ought to tell your listeners, you're not a relative of mine. I haven't paid you a penny for saying all this. Thank you very much. It's just very, very kind of you.
How is it going, by the way, the book?
Oh, I don't know how many copies it sold. It's certainly gotten a lot of attention. And this has all died down now, but for a period of time, I got, close to 1,000 emails, many of them really abusive, a few threatening physical violence. It was quite something. I had a policeman outside my house for a little while. And that in itself was an interesting experience. It does bring home, I think, how badly people in a time like this want to have something to hold on to and treat the Constitution as if it were a religious document, which of course it's not. That part just seems very odd to me. I would have thought somebody with strong religious beliefs would have been especially sympathetic to my argument, because if you have strong religious beliefs, then there's the possibility that the Constitution might conflict with those beliefs, and then I assume you would think your obligations are to God rather than to a secular document. And yet many people somehow seem to confuse religion with the Constitution, and that's just a very big mistake. This was a very, very human document written by flawed human beings.
Could you, because I thought this was a very important part of the book, you talk about 10 arguments for constitutional obedience and why they all fail. Could you highlight some of those?
Okay, so I don't have the book in front of me, so I can't remember all of them. But so people say, for example, that the Constitution has to be obeyed because it's the supreme law of the land. But it's only the supreme law of the land because the Constitution itself says that it's the supreme law of the land, and that just raises the question about whether we should obey that. Or people say, without the Constitution, we would not have civil liberties. That what would prevent the government from locking up dissenters or seizing everybody's property? The fact of the matter is that the Constitution is just a piece of paper. It's in the National Archives. If you have somebody who is evil enough to try to undo our civil liberties, they're not going to be stopped by a document. That has no, the Constitution doesn't have any troops behind it. In the end, what protects civil liberties are an aroused and informed American people who want to defend them. And if we don't have that, we're not going to be saved. We're not going to be saved by what the framers themselves called a parchment barrier. Or another argument that people make is that we, the people, consented to the Constitution. You know, one deep irony is that constitutional obedience actually violates the first three words of the Constitution itself. The Constitution says, we, the people. It doesn't say, they, the dead people. It's we, the living people, who have the right to the country we want. And we, none of us living people, consented to the document that was written in 1787. We weren't around to consent to it. So those are some of the arguments. If you want to talk about some others, we can go through them.
Oh, go right ahead. It's very, very interesting to me.
Well, so another one we've already talked about is if you don't like the Constitution, you can amend it. But the fact of the matter is, as a practical matter, we can't amend it. If we could, then it would be a much less serious problem. Or sometimes people say the Constitution is so vague that there's no need to disobey it because it's written in these grand generalities. And there the answer is actually a little more complicated. So there are some provisions that are very vague in general, like the Due Process Clause or the Equal Protection Clause or the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Where the language is very vague in general, what tends to happen is that the vagueness is filled in by current political ideology, so that, again, we have the phenomenon of people dressing up their arguments as if they were constitutional when they're really not, and demanding that other people obey, not because they've been convinced, but because they say, well, the Equal Protection Clause means this, and therefore you have to obey. Then there are other provisions that actually aren't vague at all. So one that actually has had a pretty big effect on our politics is the provision that says the President of the United States has to be a natural-born citizen. I think there's a fair chance that if that provision were not in the Constitution, Arnold Schwarzenegger might have been president of the United States. Now, some people might say that cuts in favor of constitutional obedience. It depends on what you think about Schwarzenegger. But again, this is a situation where that language was put in the document for particular reasons that made sense 200 years ago. It really doesn't make sense anymore. There might be lots of reasons why Schwarzenegger shouldn't have been president, but the fact that he was a naturalized citizen is surely not one of them. But it affects what happens in ways that take away from the American people choices that they ought to have.
Well, Professor Seidman, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. This was quite a learning session. It really was. And I could tell because people tend to listen more than call. They listen very attentively.
Or I might have just put them all to sleep.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all, I'm sure, because we'll get reaction. I'm sure we'll get reaction. So I want to thank you so much for being with us. And
thank
I want
you.
To congratulate you again on this book. It's a very good read, and it really does make sense. It's very much worth a reading. It's a great book. Unconstitutional Disobedience by Professor Lewis Michael Seidman. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to make a couple of remarks before we bring the program to an end today. We had a couple of things. Let me see what I did with them. Tomorrow, I'm going to be doing a commentary. There's been quite a bit of talk lately about the so-called recklessness of the Obama administration, and an article appeared in Forbes magazine that's worth discussing, so I'll be talking about that, and I'll be talking about some other things besides that. So we should be here again tomorrow and pick up from where we left off. Just to remind those of you who are tuning in today, tomorrow will not be our open forum. Open forum is now renamed. It is Free Your Mind Friday, and as the name suggests, it's no longer going to be held on Tuesday. It's now on Friday. And that way, it gives us time to just cover the events of the week. So I hope you can join us for that. I want to talk about a special thing that I wanted to do, which is, for lack of a better term, I'll call it peer-to-peer learning. I want to be able to capitalize on some of the evident knowledge that people have in particular areas. I can sense it from calls from time to time. If you feel that you have a handle on a particular subject and you would like to do a mini presentation, I would like you to send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com and tell me what it is you think you have a pretty good handle on and that you would like to prepare a presentation, a short presentation for the listening and learning pleasure of the listeners of this program. And I'll tell you why I'm doing that. I really believe that there's a lot of learning that can be done with each one, you know, back to the old phrase of each one teach one. And many people have acquired knowledge and expertise in an area that they may not have used in a while. And your insights could be put together in a presentation, just a short thing. But just like the more formal presentations that we do, the presentation is given uninterrupted, and then we open up for questions and comments. So send me a note if you have an interest in doing a presentation. Tell me what it is you would like to talk about. And we will say about a good, we'll start off modestly, and then you make your presentation, and we'll see how it goes. I want to be able to encourage us to view each other as, I mean, it's not just the, quote, experts and giving you the information and, you know, showering it down upon us. It's also people-to-people learning. You have acquired experience as a result of your job or a hobby or your own independent learning, and you think you can do a nice job on a particular subject that is of great interest to you, that you have done a lot of reading on, and you feel that you'd like to do that. I would invite you, and I'm inviting you today, and I wanted to talk about that today to let you know. So you can start, you know, rolling that around in your head. Write me a note at leadstories@gmail.com and tell me what it is you would like to do. And then, of course, we will make arrangements to see how we could get it done and help you develop your points and see where you're going with it. And then we do a trial balloon and see how it goes. I think it would be an exciting dimension to the program. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Certainly write me a note at leadstories@gmail.com to let me know how you're enjoying the programs and your particular observations and concerns. And you can also reach me on Facebook at Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. So with these remarks, I thank you for listening today. It was a bit heavy, a little different, but it was important because we discussed the Constitution all the time. And it is refreshing when somebody tells you that this reverence that we have for the document, you need to rethink that, because after all, it's just a document. And there's a lot of psychological conditioning that goes into getting us to accept this as the holiest of holy instructions. It can't be changed. It must be the way it is, because so many people who wrote it, they were so brilliant. But of course, we know it's flawed. We know that there are many things about it that have stymied progress and liberty and freedom for many. And it is time for us to refresh our view of the U.S. Constitution. So as Professor Seidman says, the next time somebody raises a big discussion about the Constitution, you tell them, so what? So what? And then, of course, you do your reading and you'll be able to answer appropriately. Thank you so much for joining me today. Again, stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Thanks. See you tomorrow. Thank you.